Welcome to the Solaria Report. Today is Thursday, August 20th, 2009. I'm Catherine Austin Fitz, and I'm truly delighted you could join us tonight. Again tonight, money and markets, then some good questions and ask Catherine, then a conversation with George Uhrer of Urban Survival and Peoplenomics, and then a review of the documentary Phoenix Lights. My theme tonight, all week long I keep thinking of Butch Cassidy and the Sundance Kid, when they're being chased by the Pinkerton guys, and they keep saying, who are those guys? Who are those guys? In fact, some smart guys put up on YouTube all the clips from Butch Cassidy where he says, who are those guys? Paul Atkinson, who's a very good friend of mine, dear friend who died, and I just sort of put up a little blog post describing his efforts to illuminate the black budget in the destruction of Sun Shipbuilding in Philadelphia, used to always say to me, who's doing this? And as you watch the events this week, again and again and again, you keep wanting to know, who are the people behind the veil on this one? Because what's going on is getting weirder and weirder. But let's go through. The good news this week was it was a bad week for the pro-centralization team. It's almost as though the pro-centralization team went off in the room, came up with a bunch of sort of conceptual ideas of what they were going to do and how they were going to do it. And then as they sent it out into the real world to get implemented in a complex reality with people who have very different ideas of how things could get done, the two cultures collided, everything got stuck in the mud, and I have to say the pro-centralization team looks ridiculous. Okay, the issues, many of them revolve around the economics of life versus death. Technology is literally making it possible, in theory, to organize the way we do work. So a very small percentage of the population is needed to do the fundamental work, even of a consumption society. And then the question remains, what's everybody else going to do? How are they going to get income? And what does that mean to an aging population in the first world? You know, how is their retirement going to be provided for, particularly now that all the money that was standing behind their contingent liabilities and retirement is being stolen? Nothing brought that home like the chief actuary of the largest pension fund in the country, CalPERS, standing up and saying, you know, we're going to have to cut benefits if we're going to make this be sustainable. It's so infuriated me. I put a bunch of posts up on the blog about the CalPERS announcement and ideas around that. Cash for clunkers, very bad idea. Borrow money. The government borrows money so that it can give the money to people and encourage them to borrow more money. The last thing we know is we need, as we all know, is more debt. It did pump the retail numbers for a short period of time. There's a great article that I posted on the blog by Eric Jansen, the proprietor of iTulip, about what's happening in retail, the extraordinary discounting that is going on as retailers try and stay alive and quickly and rapidly sell inventory, and a reminder of the importance of, if there's anything, any tangible you need to buy, now is the time to do it. We have a Georgia congressman at a town hall meeting, another blog post, complaining that swine flu is in danger of being used by the powers that be to achieve martial law. This is a congressman saying this in a town hall meeting. We got reports all week long of COINTELPRO efforts that were really designed to make it look like Americans are turning violent when they're not. For those of you who've never heard the word COINTELPRO, I really encourage you to go to Wikipedia and on the web and look at the history of professional governmental-funded efforts to sabotage community organizing and citizen organizing and citizen political activities at a grassroots level. We saw people turning up with rifles. Covered by CNN, where Obama's speaking, we have a radio show host, Hal Turner, claiming that he was trained by the FBI to try and encourage people to behave in ways that would entrap them. We've seen organized efforts at the town hall meetings to disrupt in a way that really prevents the expression of legitimate and very deep anger by the American people. What's fascinating, as you watch all of these different disparate attempts fail, is how well Americans are handling themselves and being effective at expressing their very legitimate concerns and anger in a very responsible way. And it's almost as though the government is not behaving as adults, but the citizens are behaving as adults, and it's kind of the tables have turned. I can't tell you how many times this week I really felt so proud to be an American. The big issue, of course, is health care, with the announcements or the leaks from the White House saying that the public option may be off the table. What you're seeing gridlock in Washington is an inevitable result of the fact that there are no solutions as long as you stay within the current boundaries. For decades now, we have had, particularly since Medicare and Medicaid got started, we have had a healthcare industry that has built higher and higher costs and expenses within boundaries that insist on tremendous suppression of healthcare knowledge and healthcare technology, and a food and lifestyle that is very toxic and very destructive of immune systems. So for example, in the 90s, when I was doing the place-based data with Community Wizard, one of the things that we found was a tremendous amount of the employment in the 90s was coming from the healthcare industry, and if you dug deep into the numbers, a lot of it was just not economic. Now, a lot of us will talk about the corporations being too greedy, but it's not just the corporations. It's an entire industry infrastructure that doesn't make economic sense without lots and lots of cheap government money to fund the explosion. When you realize that the major source of income to that industry has been coming from non-sustainable government borrowing, you start to realize the extent of the problem. The entire healthcare industry is a prisoner of the red button problem. So you have, grossly oversimplified, you have three constituencies. You have the New World Order, the pro-centralization team, and they've laid down a bunch of boundaries about what goes in the food and what goes in the water, about the industrialization of agriculture in a truly psychotic model, and very destructive of health, and all sorts of other stipulations. The way we've solved living with those stipulations is by throwing more money at the problem. So at the same time, you're doing a whole series of things that are going to kill people. You're doing a whole series of things that are supposed to save people. Now that the money is getting tight, those issues have to be faced if we were going to find some economically sustainable solution. So we've got the New World Order / pro-centralization team as one constituency. We've got the corporations and industry that wants their overhead maintained, which is another political constituency. And then you want people who want lots and lots of services with another constituency. And if you look at where the three circles overlap, there's no place that will work within the economics as the population ages, and Congress is right in the middle of it. And so if you look at if as long as we stay inside the matrix, there are no solutions. If we leave the matrix, then there are solutions. But that means Congress is going to have to turn to the New World Order and the corporations and say no. And from a political standpoint, they don't have ground to do that. So it's a big challenge, but if you're going to move outside the matrix, there are plenty of solutions to be had. State and local government, Chicago closes for a day, has literally a moratorium on most services. We see Philadelphia projecting that they may have, if they don't get a new sales tax, very draconian cuts, 1,000 policemen, fire people later. I mean, serious, and courts slowed down or shut down. So the thing we've been talking about all year long about the state and local cuts cycling through the economy is happening, and it's going to cause real pain on the ground. Everyone's on vacation this week and next, so the tension is a little bit diffused. One of the big vacation spots is that the central bankers, every year Kansas City has a big meeting of the central bankers in Jackson Hole, Wyoming, and they're up in Jackson Hole. Ben Bernanke, it starts tonight. Ben's speech is tomorrow morning. It's not expected that he'll say much new, but it's going to be interesting to see sort of what the temperament is of the central banks after they come out of the Kansas meeting. There have been, for the last 6 weeks, more and more rumors of bank holidays and or problems with the bank crashes on the bank, and I wanted to address that because I've gotten plenty of questions from subscribers. But it's also important that at a time like this, we not fall prey to rumors, but take those rumors and look at them sort of critically. So let's talk about it. There are two kinds of bank holidays that we've seen in the last 10 or 15 years, or bank crashes. If you look at the Argentina story or you look at the Russian story, which are both examples of sort of the shock doctrine of when an economy gets hit. So literally money is pulled out, global interests pull massive amounts of money out of the banks in Argentina. Literally people wake up, the banks, the banks make it impossible for them to get more than a little bit of money over time as they're trying to get their money bit by bit. Inflation takes off and they get squeezed. But in those cases, it was an economic hit. Now, in America, if there is a real problem with bank liquidity, then all the Treasury and the Federal Reserve have to do is print money. So there's no reason to have a bank crash or a bank holiday as long as you can print money. Now, one thing the Treasury and the Fed have shown is a willingness to print whatever money has to be printed. So as a practical matter, if the system doesn't want a bank crash or doesn't want a bank holiday, then the thing to worry about is inflation. Now, what we're watching both in commodities and most commodities, not all, and in the average household budget, what we're seeing is inflation, despite the fact that we have tremendous deflationary pressures. We've printed significant amounts of money. The financing of the government deficit is causing the Fed to monetize the deficit. That's going to increase. We have big Treasury auctions next week. So what's happening in the banking system has real consequences for inflation. And right now, inflation is the biggest risk. The dollar is far from its low. It seems to be performing pretty well. Gold is still in the 900s, but it's not skyrocketing. So there's no sign of any kind of symptoms that would mean a bank holiday or crash soon. Now, let's talk about another reason that people might be worried about a bank holiday. If we had a huge swine flu event and no one felt comfortable in going out, or there were real problems keeping operations going, that could be a reason that a governmental entity, or in some of the rumors it's the State Department, would plan on stockpiling currency or stockpile goods and services to keep going without being able to go to the bank. So there are reasons other than the banking system. It's very important to understand that in the United States, the banks are backed by FDIC insurance. The FDIC insurance fund is funded by fees from the bank. And as long as a bank workout or takeover by the federal government is funded from fees that the banks have paid into the fund, you have a governance structure for the banks which is different than if the FDIC fund were to run out of money and had to be bailed out by Treasury. So you have one governance structure, one set of laws currently. If that should change and Treasury should take it over, then we're going to see a much more political situation where a little bit akin to what we've seen with the auto dealers, which is you're going to have political operatives, politically appointed officials who can decide which banks live and which banks die, not necessarily because they're strong or weak or not necessarily because they need capital or not, but because they want the bigger banks to have the benefit of market share. Because behind what we're watching with the bank rumors, I believe, is really a marketing campaign. As the economy shrinks and people are more and more angry about the bailouts, the big banks need a way to hold deposits and maintain loyalty of customers. And there's nothing like fear of bank holidays or banks crashing to keep people coming into the big banks. So beware the politics on this thing. Some people have said to me, well, that means I should be worried about banking at a small bank. No, I disagree. You should be worried about banking at a small bank if it's sloppy and overextended, because if you're the big banks and you're looking to bolster your deposits, the simplest way to do it as time goes by is to be able to take over those banks and that market share. So you want to make sure if you're in a small bank, you're in one that's well-run, conservatively managed, and impeccable about its regulations. So I'm a skeptic about the rumors. I'm not a skeptic that something could happen in the long run, but we're going to need to see a lot more inflation and the inability of the Fed to monetize or back the FDIC fund just because the federal credit is tapped out. If that happens, you know, we're going to have a much bigger problem than banks and FDIC, because we're going to have a major problem in the bond market. Okay, that's it for money and markets. This is still the quiet time. We're coming into a period where, the different wars we're watching between the big guys or the little guys or different factions at the top are going to heat up tremendously in September. So watch in September and October for a game of musical chairs and a lot of tension at the national and international level. Okay, quickly, ask Catherine. I got a great question about a mortgage reset. Somebody with a variable rate mortgage had did the deal with one company. That company was taken by another. They got a notice of reset that appears to change the terms. The question is it safe to go back and try and get it straightened out? The answer is yes. If you've gotten information from your servicer or your lender that indicates a change in terms, what you just need to do is talk with the servicer, use your documentation, and make sure things are clear and straightened out and everybody understands, why they're doing what they're doing. Pursuing it and making sure it's in accordance with the original contract will not make you a target, or should, very unlikely to make you a target, and you want to go ahead and do that and get that done as best you can. That was another question. We got a couple of other great questions, but I'd like to handle them with our guest, George Yor, tonight. So I'm going to ask them of George, one about TIFs and another about Freedom County, Texas. So I'll hold off until George joins us. Okay, so George, are you unmuted?
I'm here.
Oh, good. Okay, well, let me... it was about 3 or 4 years ago I started reading a website called Urban Survival, and I just loved it. And then I found a book. It's called, George, give me the title. It's $10,000.
How to Live on $10,000 a Year or Less.
$10,000 a Year. And clearly the author was unbelievably inventive, but the thing I loved George had a way on his website, now he has a subscription service, I'm a subscriber, Peoplenomics, where he can connect all the dots of what's going on, kind of see the game. I love that, and then bring it back down to what do I do in a very concrete and specific way. So, and then I discovered after I started to read Cliff High and the WebBot Project that you've been in cahoots with the WebBot Project for quite some time.
Only since July of 2001, before 9/11. yeah,
only
for almost 9 years now.
And wow,
it's interesting because when I was I kept getting Cliff to keep the project alive. No, it's terrible. It's emotionally draining looking at all the bad stuff coming in our future. It makes me nuts.
Uh-huh.
And I said, no, you've got to have faith. You've got to stay with it because it's so critically important to people.
Uh-huh.
To his credit as a human, he has persevered. And the project is, I won't say stable, but for a garage project, It is hitting way above chance, and we're just pleased as punch about it.
Now, George, your website is Urban Survival, but you live in rural Texas. Can you tell us how this happened?
Well, yeah, I was. It's a weird story. once upon a time, I was a big city newscaster up in the Seattle area. And one thing led to another, and I became senior vice president of a small international airline, Cayman Airways, down serving the Cayman Islands out of Houston and Miami and so forth. And then I came back and
Houston to Cayman Islands. Oh my, what were you flying?
727 series 227 advanced with the Dash 17 power plant. Great airplane. But one of the neat things about that experience was I got to ride up in first class all the time, and I got to see the guys coming out of Texas with the literally the suitcases full of cash when they were emptying out the SNL crisis had had not quite popped up. And so I got to, I got firsthand after my big city news gathering experience and being around some financial geniuses, the late Dr. Paul Erdman, who did the crash of 79, the Silver Bears, and so forth. Well, I got to ride in first class on Cayman Airways jets with these guys from Houston who were flying some dough out of the country.
Right. I was the FHA commissioner watching them buy all the RTC properties up at 10 cents on the dollar with that cash.
Well, this was in 83 when they were still taking cash out.
Oh, okay.
What these guys were doing was they would all go play tennis or whatever in town, and they would buy a large condo or a large apartment complex, and then one of their buddies would reappraise it for maybe $1 million more than it should be. They would take the loan proceeds, and they'd take the loan proceeds out of the country, because remember, loan proceeds are not taxable as income, right? And so what was happening is all this money that had come basically from refining these big apartments left the country and went to the offshore tax havens, Turks and Caicos, the ABC Islands, and what have you. And then these savvy business guys would go back, throw their hands up and say, oh, I'm bankrupt, I have no money. And that was before the fine art of 1099-ing, the guys who got the cash came into practice widespread.
Right.
And so these guys, a lot of them ended up living happily ever after offshore with really good streams of revenue going forward through locally held private trusts where they don't even show up. Their names don't even show up. I mean, it's really pretty slick. And
right.
So whenever I read things like, you know, UBS is going to unveil 4,500 names and maybe more, I can't bleed no real tears on that, because, you know, we all live in the greatest country in the world, and to keep it that way costs money, and that people should be able to go hide their money outside the system while regular working class folks like us pay taxes. You know, that just doesn't seem right.
No, it doesn't seem right. Although I will say that, you know, sort of that individual tax evasion is tiny as a percentage of the theft.
Sure. And the absurdity of much of what goes on in terms of government spending. You've done a wonderful job of exposing the black budgets and so forth. I mean, that's just horrific, the amount of money that goes down the rat hole and just gone out of your pocket into theirs.
That's one of the things I wanted to talk with you about tonight, as you know, is sort of what I call business model gone wild, which is how did we get here? How did we get to a global financial system which is as absurdly corrupt and as wealth-destroying as this one?
Well, it's actually an oscillation that you can trace back to the middle to late 1800s. In fact, we could probably go to the adventures of Henrik Lorentz rewriting modern physics as it relates to electricity. Purportedly at the behest of J.P. Morgan, circa 1896, because what was happening back then, Marconi et al. Were not really getting very far with their spark gap transmitters. and so forth. So the thinking purportedly of some of the rich, rich industrialists, the guys that, you know, did things like put U.S. Steel together back when and so forth, was that they could see that electricity could be quite something. And what they did is rewrote the laws of physics so that the frothy vacuum from or zero point energy could not be logically pulled out of thin air. It's very possible to do that if you look at the complete equations of Oliver Heaviside. And Oliver Heaviside, of course, was a guy who was like, you know, the genius, Ian Maxwell. And in fact, Maxwell was doing lectures in the UK about vortexes and what is it that pushes magnetic lines of force out into those donut shapes. What is that orthogonal stuff that pushes magnetic fields around? So that was going on as early as 1870. And so when you think about it, if you ever watched that TV show, The Wild Wild West?
I don't have a TV, George, and I haven't had one.
Oh, you're smart.
1984.
Okay, well, The Wild Wild West, I think, was actually out back then. But anyway,
oh, really? Okay.
Yeah, it was a 1890s kind of Western, but the idea was that there was some super high tech around, and there was a character, a Dr. Lovelace, who had mastered like atomic energy and all kinds of other things. And every once in a while, I recall that when I'm studying this period, and I think to myself, is this kind of like old Close Encounters, where they're trying to tell us something out of Hollywood? So that's like the first thing that happened, and so the industrialists and the bankers go back and forth as far as who's going to be the front guy. But the real groundwork was when J.P. Morgan was a very competitive guy. And he was competing with this fellow named Edison, who'd figured out lights, and this other guy named Westinghouse, who had figured out alternating current using Nikola Tesla's technology.
Right, and Westinghouse was the big Tesla supporter.
Yeah, right.
My understanding is it was J.P. Morgan and Edison who really got together and
sort of went the other way. Yeah. Well, and so I would consider that was like the first business model. It was some technology competition going on. And then along came J.P. Morgan's boy, J.P. Jr., Jack, they called him, and he got really involved in getting the advancing the interests on the financial side, because he was critical to the 1913, and I call this really the second hijacking of the business model, was as G. Edward Griffin outlines in Creature from Jekyll Island, that's when the Federal Reserve Act was sort of passed in the wee hours. And curiously, also around that time, we notice in history this guy by the name of George Herbert Walker. And you know who he is a progenitor to. So everything goes along, and the money guys get to have their depression. As one of my friends, who's a very serious player in the bond field, says, the purpose of a good depression is to return money to its rightful owners. and unfortunately, that's what depressions do. So that explains why the financial baroons came out and took everybody's money away that they could in the period from 1929, through the onset of hostilities in World War II. But then what happens is we get a flip in the business model, and we go from the money guys, and we flip back to the industrialist. And so you have World War II going on after the Great Depression. I've got a couple of other like sub flips that have gone on at this point, but the Great Depression was the longest reign through that point of the purely monetary kind of guys, the real financial powers behind the scenes. Then along came the next hijacking was World War II, where the United States was, and there's, this is all coming out now, what, 70 years or so after the fact, we're learning about how the U.S. actually knew that the Japanese fleet was out there and headed for no good, and how we had started blocking some of their oil shipments out of Indonesia and that area so that they would be forced to go into the war. So, but the purpose of World War II was really twofold. First, build lots of capacity, build up lots of demand. A lot of destruction, though, at the same time, because Nicholas Kondratiev, who's sort of my hero in all this stuff, really the founder of long-wave economic studies, in about 1926 observed, and in fact he was a Russian and told Joseph the Madman Stalin, that I got good news and bad news for you. The bad news is that the West is going to rise again. The good news, though, is they're going to have a terrible depression before that happens. Well, Kondratiev got sent off to Siberia. We had the Great Depression. Along came World War II, and wouldn't you know it, Russia was in the thick of it. And there was even a lot of talk back in the Russian Revolution days, 1916-17, that certain U.S. industrialists had been funneling money to the Bolsheviks because they wanted to set up that Hegelian dialectic. They were actually quite expert at setting up the chessboard and then taking all the pieces.
Oh, yeah. It's clear that Wall Street financed both sides.
Oh, sure.
And
sure.
I don't know if you've read, there's a wonderful book, Trading with the Enemy, about the same process during World War II.
Yes.
Where you literally have the U.S. government at various times helping the Nazis stay in the war.
Mm-hmm.
So it's quite.
Yeah, Prescott Bush and those folks.
Right.
Yeah.
Right.
And by the way, that sort of continued. You know, once we got the industrialists and that war machine built, one of the reasons for the war in Korea, one could argue, is that with the war in Korea, the industrialists sort of went into overtime. And that's when we had, following that war, we had Averell Harriman and others come forth who stoked the flames of the Cold War, and that kept that spending going. And it was very easy at that point for things like UFO discoveries to be classified high military secrets. And thanks to the Cold War, there was enough security infrastructure and worries about Russians and Cubans and commies in general that nobody would dare break security. And that's also a period when we had the McCarthy hearings. And again, that absolute obedience to the state without question and so forth was really pushed to the fore, and it became almost a social mantra. And so then we had the period where the industrialists came back in the middle to late 50s, and Eisenhower was out warning about the military-industrial complex, and then the Cuban Missile Crisis. So once again, you know, heat up that war stuff, and you get the ability to tax and so on. And then we went through an interesting change with the elimination of President Kennedy. And I
just mentioned last week we talked about the JFK.
The assassination removal.
Movie. Yeah.
Yeah. What's your conclusion? I mean, it was because he was going to start shutting down, closing down around the Fed, right?
If you look at what Kennedy was doing, it wasn't any particular policy. It was, you know, probably number one was the what he wanted to do in Vietnam. But he was basically cutting the power lines of the secret government.
Exactly.
And
exactly.
I think you had the overt and the covert, you know, the overt government and the covert government had a war, and the covert government killed the overt government leader and put their guy in place.
Exactly. And without the Cuban Missile Crisis as the setup to it, I doubt we would have ever had Vietnam. And that, of course, set the way for the covert government to get into the real money, which was the drug manufacturing and so forth.
Right, because if you look at how the black budget, what I call the black budget, is financed,
uh-huh.
The key dates are 1913, you create the Fed.
Yep.
1934, you create the FHA fund, and was that Social Security too?
Yep.
Because
yep.
Basically the FHA fund, the housing and Social Security are your big slush funds. Then in 1947 we have the National Security Act, which allows all sorts of provisions with the money, and then you pass the CIA Act, and the two in combination allow the black budget to claw money out of agency budgets all across the government. And then in 1980, you make it possible for that money to go directly to corporations. So literally,
what a nice slow motion hijack of the country. I mean, it's a slow motion coup.
It's amazing. I just saw an interview with one person who said, I've got it up on my blog in a video. He said it so succinctly. He said, the problem is not that we lost control of the government. The problem is the government lost control of the technology. Because if you look at all the different, you know, particularly the 47 and the 49 acts in combination with the executive orders that followed it.
That was all after Roswell.
We said government, it's all after we got the UFO technology from
right.
the Nazis.
Right.
So what we said is government has to pay a group of private corporations as much money as they want to build technology that they will own and control, and we're not allowed to know about or ask questions outside of the congressional appropriation. And that's one of the reasons the drug money in Vietnam was so important. The covert government needed to control the Golden Triangle to make their black budget money work.
You know what's really interesting, Catherine, is that when people like yourself and myself who've actually studied this stuff and have taken the time to put the pieces together talk about it and say, okay, go look up the date of Roswell, go look up the 1949 date on some of the security acts and so forth, look at the coincidental timing when somebody like McCarthy comes along and the whipping up the warfare, and we have that going on now. I mean, we're at that juncture where we're seeing the frenzy about, oh, we must get in and defend those poor people in Afghanistan. It's like, what? You know, oh, you mean we have to defend the poppies? Ah, check.
Well, but here's the thing. The average American, you know, my friends and family are busy. And they're busy people. They're giving people. They're responsible people. They're focused on their responsibilities, whether it's taking care of their family, taking care of their job. They're busy. And they can't fathom that this thing got as big and out of control as it did without them noticing.
What,
you know something else? They can't fathom a culture. You know, we literally now in this country have different parallel universes living side by side who can't fathom, you know, what it's like to live in the other.
But
the guys
so
who operate
easy.
The black budget, they can't fathom what it's like to, you know, have a family and, you know, raise puppies and kids and, you know, be a real estate broker in Hardeman County, Tennessee.
But it makes it so easy for guys like Karl Rove to come along who understand market segmentation perfectly and play segment versus segment. And the other thing that most people don't realize is that the completion of the financial coup had its roots in the late 1960s when there was a landmark Supreme Court decision that allowed states to have whatever they wanted in the way of a usury law.
Right.
Typically, the usury laws were 12% or 10%. But what the Supreme Court said, you can do whatever you want inside of your own borders. And so like a reasonable group of people like in Kansas, the interest rate cap in Kansas, depending on the situation, is today anywhere from, I think it's 14.45 up to 18%. So you're thinking to yourself, well, where the hell are these 33, 35% kind of interest rates on credit cards coming from? And the answer is out of state. And the Supreme Court decision in the late 60s basically marked the important transition from where the people with a black budget actually had to have the charade of consumer goods. You'll notice the standard of living was coming up very nicely until about the middle of the 1960s. My dad was a firefighter in Seattle, and he was able to support wife and three kids, three of us in college, and having just a decent life without his wife having to work. Now,
right.
We didn't have a big house, but and we had a house payment, and we had a color TV set and that kind of stuff, but we were by no means, you know, upper crust. But money was tightly managed and so forth. But what happened was once we hit that nonlinear point, it no longer was important for the black budget folks to go through the whole charade of manufacturing goods and so forth. They just started manufacturing money, and the easiest way to do that was push credit out,
right,
and plug in additional zeros as required. And since that time, it's worked genius level for them.
Right. Well, once you get everybody in debt or dependent on federal government money, they have to do what you say.
Absolutely. You know, right. one of the things up at Jackson Hole this week that I would love to be, I think you said, you know, let the fly on the wall in the corner. And
no, I've been up in Jackson Hole. It's not as exciting as it sounds.
Well, what I would love to do, though, is get like the Japanese finance minister aside and say, hey, what about those guys with that $134 billion worth of bearer bonds? What was the deal with that? Was that part of the black budget money, or what's up?
The thing that would scare you, George, is if we went up to Jackson Hole and everybody took a truth tag and we could ask them a lot of questions, the thing that would scare you to death is they know a lot less than you think. Okay.
No, I see their policies. And that's what's really interesting about it, because in so many ways, you look at these discrete events and you think to yourself, golly, maybe this really is just like putting that drop of blue food color in a glass of water, and you know how it gets all confused and stringy and chaotic looking. Maybe we really are just looking at democracy noise on the one hand, and then you go,
No.
Phoenix lights fly over, and you go, well, hell, that ain't no artifact.
Here is the challenge, though. If you're rising in the New World Order hierarchy, as I was once upon a time,
yep,
you're busy, and you're focused on your specific deal.
Oh, you have
and
to
you
be.
Run into these things that are like anomalies that don't make any sense, and you're like, what's that? And then you get busy and can't dig in and investigate it. And so you can get pretty high and really not have a clue sort of what's going on exactly. I mean, in 1994, I was sitting on the board of directors of Sallie Mae, which is at the time one of the biggest publicly traded financial institutions in the country. And I started to ask them about questions about derivatives, and I kept apologizing, you know, I'm not a derivatives expert, this is a stupid question. And what came out, there were seven bank chairmen, vice chairmen on the board, the vice chairman of Morgan, Harris Trust, I guess First Chicago,
uh-huh,
you know, big banks. And what I realized as I was asking questions, and they started to ask questions, is they didn't know either. And I thought, oh, my, you know, at that point we're up to about $54 trillion, which is nothing compared to where we are now in derivatives. And what I realized is the people governing these institutions don't begin to understand, you know, the individual deals, let alone how to manage a portfolio of them.
Yeah.
And that's not an accident. Because somewhere somebody does.
Yeah, somebody. Well, and I know some of the people who actually helped invent CMOs.
Right.
And for them, it was basically a math exercise. It was, okay, the task is make money. How do we do this? Well, if you have enough mortgages all bundled up together over time, they will perform kind of like a bond, provided you don't run into this extreme case, which is highly unlikely. Well, guess where we are? We're flat on our ass in the middle of highly unlikely right now.
Okay, so we have the finance guys in remission. We have the guys who control the technology starting to rise again. We have these parallel universes. We have things getting weirder every minute.
Yeah, isn't it great?
What do we do? What do we do, George?
Oh, it's really simple. Demonetize.
Okay.
Demonetize.
Okay. What does demonetize mean?
Demonetize means get rid of the money demon as best you can. There are lots of ways to do it. One way. I'll give you a whole list of them. Let's say you're living in the city, and you can't leave the city because that's your place of employment. You're for whatever reason, you're not comfortable striking out as a rugged individualist and going out to the country and homesteading. So what do? You band together with maybe a brother, a sister, a cousin, a something, and you pay off a piece of property. The first step on the road to financial freedom is trying to eliminate as much debt as you can. That's why I was appalled at cash for clunkers. I can't tell
you. I know. Can you imagine all these people who should be getting out of debt? They're trying to get them more in debt.
Yeah. I mean, how do you fix a system by going more in debt? Help me. I'm confused on this. You know, it's like Biden economics, which just,
well, because you're not trying to fix the system.
Exactly. You're just trying to muddle through to the next election.
Right.
And unfortunately, there's a lot of that. Okay, so that's one way to do it is band together. Another way is reduce your expenses by not owning a car. In a lot of major cities, I've got three kids that live in Seattle. They're all 30-ish, and between three of them, they have one car, and they don't use it very often, and it's a smart car. And so the reason that they're doing that is what? Maybe it's because car ownership is absurd.
Is smart car like Zipcar?
Yeah.
My sister uses Zipcar.
Yeah, a little shoebox car.
Right. Oh, no, the ones you rent.
It's not a flex car. They used flex cars
before
they had enough utilization that the three of them could use a smart car.
Okay.
But, yeah, flex car is another great program. But some city, well, Portland, Oregon has that light rail system. It's really cool. New York, you can't afford a car.
Oh, New York, you don't need a car.
Yeah, exactly. Well, and you don't in many cities until you get sucked into the dream that we being those of us who are over 40, we're getting sucked into about, got to live in the suburbs, have big four-bedroom house, nice green belt, good neighbors. You know, it's like, and then I got over that and moved on to a sailboat, which is way, might as well be living in a tin can. But for 10 years, I had a great time. I had a totally mobile home that could go any place in the world.
Uh-huh.
And
what Dmitry Orlov does. He lives on a sailboat.
Oh, well, see, he's an incredibly smart guy, too.
Yeah.
Because sailboats give you a kind of an independence and some self-confidence that most people are sorely lacking. Another thing you can do, you can start up your own business. It takes very little initiative to find a way to make some money, but most people won't do it. There are some new books on barter coming out. There's one by B.J. Fuller called Barter Secrets. I got a review copy of it, and I'll be putting a link up on my website one of these days when I get around to that. But it goes into the whole, there's a pyramid. Things that are of higher value on the pyramid, so you want to trade from lower on the pyramid goods to higher value goods. Cash and gold and things like that are way up at the top, and things like disposable electronics are way down at the bottom. But you can learn that art of bartering. And so, there's lots of ways to get out of money. I've been telling people for, over a year, get a garden in so you make all your mistakes now while you can still run down to the store if your crops don't work.
Right. The first thing I did, though, is I put in orchards before I even put in the garden.
Yeah, that was really smart of you.
Yeah.
Unfortunately, though, I did not do that here in East Texas. So I feel very dumb, but see, you're smarter than I am, so it makes sense.
I have a dinner group with people here locally who are very interested in helping each other become self-sufficient, and I would never have done if it wasn't for their help and instructions. And so the first thing I did was not plant an orchard. The first thing I did was I identified the people here who know a lot about what you ought to do to demonetize.
Right.
And
right.
Because I came from Wall Street. I don't know the first thing about that. And in fact, they're coming over for dinner on Saturday night. And I've learned that they're the ones who got me getting my ham radio license. So.
And I've got to congratulate you on that.
Well, I haven't got it, so don't congratulate me.
Yeah, but that's another way to demonetize, because some people I know pay $100 a month for a cell phone. And I'm going, are you crazy? You know what?
Well, you can't remember. You can't talk about business on a ham radio.
Yeah, I know. So. But that's why I have a regular landline phone that nobody can listen to except the echelon listening stations in New Zealand and Australia. You know, and I'd like to, you know, hi to them tonight too. I'm sure they're listening.
The funny thing is they listen to every phone call on the planet, so.
Yeah, exactly. And what would a good keyword be? No, we don't need to go there. But I guess the long and short of it is if you consciously teach yourself that inflation is not the price of goods going up, it's really the value of the purchasing power of your dollar going down. And then
right.
If you realize that your quality of life is not defined by pieces of paper with zeros, although I now have 3 $100 trillion Zimbabwe notes.
I know. I'm so impressed that you got those.
I'm like, you know, that's almost enough for a cup of coffee in Zimbabwe.
Okay, so let's say, George, we've demonetized completely.
Sure.
As much as we can, but we still have assets, you know, and we don't want to buy anything else for our home base or, you know, there's no more supplements we can buy.
You got solar panels?
Okay. Let's assume we've done all that.
You got a well? You got all that stuff. All right.
If you've got everything.
We'll be right over.
What do you do next?
In my case, I made a personal choice that was really simple. I've looked at all the available data. Right now, the Fed is playing a very difficult balancing act. They are faced with incipient deflation, which normally would increase the purchasing power of your dollar. But at the same time, they've also been printing money up so fast that there should be tremendous price inflation offsetting that. So even though it looks from an economic standpoint like we should be going to higher prices, but wait, those statistics say we should be going to lower prices. We seem stuck in the middle, and I don't have the definitive answer. So what
I call it the slow burn.
Yeah, it's a slow burn. And so what I've done is I said, okay, I'm going to buy 2 lottery tickets. One of my lottery tickets is an index treasury called TIPS. Treasury indexed.
And that was one of the questions I have from one of the subscribers. Here it is. Why does George Ure suggest we buy TIPS? He said even a third of portfolio treasuries would be one of the better places to park.
Yeah, until we can see for sure which way this thing is going to break. Because
now, how do you feel about financing the pro-centralization team?
Oh, it doesn't bother me. I mean,
okay.
I don't want to do it. But I've got my solar panels in my well, and what I'm trying to do, and I've got my garden, and I've got a couple of years of food, and I've got seeds, and I've got, you know, 2 rototillers plus a tractor plus, you know, at some point you want to have some capital so that even though you may correctly say that I'm financing the pro-centralization team. At the same time, when somebody gets into trouble, if I can pick up an adjoining 27-acre piece of property for, say, $1,000 an acre when things are really, really bad and we're getting there, then I want to have the ready cash to be able to do that.
Right. So you want to be liquid.
I want to be liquid with some
portion. And you want inflation protection.
And the inflation protection is the other side of it, which
right.
is an equal amount in gold and silver and not as paper. I mean, as real, get away from it, or me and Mr. AK will come have a talk with you, or me and Mr. Glock will be talking with you.
Not everybody not every subscriber knows what a Glock is, George.
A Glock is a 9mm pistol, which has you can buy throwaway barrels for. I mean, there's just a lot of.
Yeah, I have a Glock.
You do? I don't like mine as well as my Ruger, frankly. My Ruger.
I have a Ruger and a Glock.
Which one do you prefer?
I like the Glock. I got the Glock because I wanted more rounds.
Okay. Well, you get 2 more rounds in your Ruger?
Glock. My Ruger has 10, and my Glock has many more.
Which Ruger do you have?
I'm not going to say.
Oh, okay. Sorry. didn't mean to pry. But that's one of the one of the joys, I guess, of being out in the country. If I want to go out and do some
target practice.
Yeah, bump fire with an AK. It's like I call my neighbors and go, "Hey, if it sounds like there's an invasion going on over here, it's just like repelling borders practice." And they go, "Oh, okay, cool." And that's the joy of East Texas. I mean, everybody kind of watches everybody else's backside, and
the other question I wanted to ask you, got from a subscriber. Do you know anything about there's a website, Freedom County, Texas?
Never heard of it.
Group of people. I'll send you the URL.
Okay.
A group of people are proposing to get together and move to a county where enough of them can influence the local government and get their guy elected sheriff.
Oh.
And the guy they have running for sheriff looks like a pretty good guy. And the reason I thought this was very interesting is I've focused a lot of attention on the importance of a sheriff and the powers of a sheriff. And during the last couple of presidential election campaigns, I keep saying to everybody, don't worry about who's the president.
Yeah,
take all your money and time and focus on making sure you control the sheriff.
Yeah. I mean, if you control the judges, the sheriff, and the local prosecuting attorney, you have got control of your community still. That is.
Well, there are 3,100 counties. If we control 3,100 counties, we control the country.
Yeah, exactly. Exactly.
Right.
And a lot of the powers that the federal government is exercising were never really ceded by any of the states to the central government. They just sort of invented their way into it.
Well, what's very important to understand is the reason we're watching a real shock doctrine effort to implode small business on Main Street and small farms is by getting everyone dependent on central, on government money. That's how you get them to not be able to exercise their local rights.
Exactly. And things like the National Animal Identification System,
right.
Voluntary, my foot. The way they're doing this is really curious, though. It's one of the reasons that I haven't signed up for any of the U.S. Department of Ag programs, because the deal with that is as soon as you start going into Department of
right,
Ag
they,
programs,
they basically control your property.
Then they can come visit you anytime they like. But if
right.
I'm not involved with USDA and I simply sell like a goat at market, well, I'm sorry. No, I'm still an independent guy. I'm sure at some point they'll try to come out and say, "Well, Mister, you've got 43 goats out here, and those are unlicensed goats, and they might fart, so we have to impose the fart tax." and you've seen that. I mean, that's the idiocy of it.
Here's what
taxing
we're seeing.
Cow farts. I mean,
we're
really?
Seeing more and more people say on healthcare reform.
Yeah.
This is a symptom of a deeper problem. There's a deeper problem with the government. And you're just seeing across the board in the food safety stuff, in how there's a real pushback. And it's the pushback, George, of very responsible, intelligent, capable people who don't want to be bothered with politics. But if they're going to have to wake up and do something, they're waking up. And
they are starting to wake up. And
they're
and,
mad.
And I
don't mean mad in a stupid way. I mean mad in a smart way.
Yeah, and they're ready to do what I'm doing essentially boils down to I'm voting with my wallet in the most effective way I can so that I have as little beholden to somebody other than myself as possible. Like it or not, the government is my silent partner in my property because I have to pay property tax.
Right.
The government's my silent partner because I have to have a driver's license, because if you drive without one, somebody's going to try to throw you in jail, even though you're not using it in commerce and you ain't supposed to have one. You can be right on those things. If you mentioned one thing. I want you to go into it a little bit because I haven't heard you mention it before.
Except we have to go into Phoenix Lights.
Oh, that's right. We're running late.
Phoenix Lights is a documentary. It's a documentary made by a doctor in Arizona who filmed the sighting of a UFO that flew over a significant part down the side of Arizona very slowly and was observed by thousands, if not hundreds of thousands of people, including the governor, who has since sort of witnessed.
Yes, Fife Symington.
By Symington. there are a couple things about this which are very, very interesting. You heard George and I talking about, free energy technology being suppressed.
And other branch of physics basically being hijacked.
Right, for over a century. One of the things I didn't mention when I talked about healthcare, but if you don't know the history and the story of Royal Rife and sort of the various cures on cancer, it's another great example and of technologies, incredible technologies that have been suppressed. And it's very hard for people who are not aware of these histories to say, well, how could the cures to cancer exist and me not know about them? You know, this member of my family, that member of my family has died from cancer. How could this have happened? You know, how could that be so? Well, when you watch Phoenix Lights, I'll never forget, George, you know, I've done all this writing about $4 trillion that disappeared from the federal government.
Right, right.
And I took a look at that spaceship floating over Phoenix, and I said, you know, I bet Lockheed Martin would charge $4 trillion to build that. There's the $4 trillion.
And
would cost $4 trillion.
and watching the Phoenix Lights, you also get this weird sense of the timeliness of how then-Governor Simonton just 5 months later was out of office on some trumped-up charge.
Right, and it may or may not be about.
It's just the coincidental timing jumped out at me. It's just like when you were in government in 97, I think you saw a lot of honest, good.
A lot of honest people got pushed out in 96. It's as though somebody blew the whistle when the budget deal didn't go through at the end of 95. The New World Order said, okay, we're pulling all the money out. Get rid of the honest people because we're going to have a bubble. We're going to pull all the money out. We're just going to completely re-engineer this thing. It's over. We've had it with democracy. It doesn't work. And, and that's what the president of CalPERS told me in the spring of 1997. They've given up on the country. They're pulling all the money out starting in the fall. And that was when the $4 trillion started to go missing. It was the end of 1997. But anyway, on Phoenix Lights, one of the things I found fascinating about this documentary, and it's really, if you haven't seen it, I really encourage all of the listeners to go get a copy and watch it. I was sitting in my office, and one of the local farmers walked in right when it came out and said, have you seen Phoenix Lights? I said, no, what's that? And she said, it's a documentary about a UFO, and what you need to understand is I just rented it at Movie Gallery in Bolivar, Tennessee, and because I just happened to see it right sitting there in the, you know, sort of new things. So it's being promoted in Movie Gallery in Bolivar, Tennessee, and she said, I find that absolutely fascinating. So I got it and watched it, but I looked at it and I said, you know, this is one of the best examples I've ever seen that will help people understand that this parallel world exists of incredible technology, the fact that people are sitting around and taking peak oil seriously when there's this demonstration. I mean, whatever is running that spaceship, George, you know it's not fossil fuels.
Not only is it not fossil fuels, but we're not sure that the guys who have developed that technology haven't made some friends from other places and other worlds.
Well, you know, who knows? The Nazis had UFO technology. There's a lot of documentation about that. We know, we know that the industrialists who we were talking about got that technology at the end of World War II.
Right.
And they've had an infinite amount of money to develop it.
And a lot of real estate in South America, which has become recently popular with departed from office presidents, down in that
right.
neighborhood where there's a lot of once German and Odessa types.
So the reason I wanted us also to watch Phoenix Lights is when we think about solutions, whether it's solutions to the healthcare problems or solution to the budget deficit or solution to whatever. One thing to understand is if the technology that exists, which is available whether it's energy or healthcare, continues to be suppressed, you know, in with those kinds of boundaries, there are no solutions. But you unsuppress the technology we know exists, and you apply it in a healthy way, and the boundaries of what's possible open up tremendously. And I think it's very important to look at this kind of stuff to understand that the potential for those boundaries to be changed dramatically is very real and exists.
That was good.
George.
It was, no, I mean, I'm just going, yeah. Demonetize. And I want to, Cliff and I have got a little arrangement. If he ever manages to hijack one of those big Phoenix Lights things, or I do, guess what? We'll drop by and pick you up. We'll go out and have pie.
Well, it's funny. I was arguing with a group of newsletters. They were saying that the dollar was going to crash. And I said, look, the guy driving the UFO and Phoenix Lights, would, you know, the question is what he wants. And if he wants the dollar, and I shouldn't assume it's a him, but it could be her, if she wants the dollar to stay up, it will.
Yeah, there's just no question. And that's why I say I've hedged my bet so that so that I'm trying to protect what, you know, both of my dimes, right? I'm trying to protect them regardless of which way the powers that be throw
the
game.
Exactly.
And that's the only thing you can do, I think.
That's what we all have to do. We have to try and become as immune to the battles between the finance and the industrialists, particularly because the technology has gotten this amazing.
And
anyway,
in addition to that, try not to be taken by the shock and awe or to get sucked into the drama of things that are just way overworked in the media, and they're only designed, best I can tell, to be used as control mechanisms for mass psychology. Things like the swine flu.
You know, frankly, very, very simply, we should stop reading the New York Times and Washington Post and make sure we read Urban Survival, because then we will laugh all the way.
Yeah, and we will. I always try to maintain the only thing funnier than my website is the world.
Okay, well, George, thank you so much for joining us for the Solari Report. It was wonderful, and we hope you have we're coming into that time when Cliff says we're going to have some pretty wild times. So
yeah,
the next big date is August 22nd, which is this Saturday, right?
Well, we're actually in the window now. The window opened on the 16th, and it sort of peaks around the 22nd, and then we've got another window around September 22, which may be bank holiday or a big financial bank kind of collapse deal. And then we have the October 25 Israeli bombing of Iran or swine flu. That's kind of hard to read. And then like 4 weeks after that, we've got North Korea doing something crazy.
Oh, well.
So, I mean, it's like, yeah, fine.
I'm just going to keep pruning my orchard.
Well, save some pies for us. We'll come up and visit.
Okay, George, thank you again, ladies and gentlemen.
Thank you.
Next week we have, or September 3rd, we've got Dr. Laura Thompson rejoining us to talk about the swine flu vaccination and natural remedies in case you get the swine flu. And then the following week, Precious Metals Market Report with Franklin Sanders. No Solari Report next week. Thank you very much for joining us. Remember, don't worry if there is a conspiracy. If you're not in one, you need to start one. Good night and good luck.